Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Guinea-Bissau coup or stage coup. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Muizu Mutali. The music in the background is True Don't Lie by Femi Kuti. On November 26, people in Guinea-Bissau woke up to hear that there had been a coup in their country. Many within the country and beyond have questioned whether it was actually a military coup, but rather it was a plan by the incumbent president, Omaro Sissoko Embalo, and forces allied with him to present the official release of the November 23rd legislative and presidential elections. The presidential election was between President Omaro Sissoko Embalo and opposition candidate Fernando Diaz da Costa of the Social Renewal Party. The military arrested Fernando Diaz and Domingos Simons Pereira, president of the African Party of Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde, PAIGC, and president of the National People's Assembly. The process before the election featured undemocratic and, experts say, illegal disqualifications of the candidates of the African Party of Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde, PAIGC. Joining Africa Now to dissect and contextualize the situation in Guinea-Bissau is Imani Naumoja. Imani Naumoja is a member of the Political Bureau and National Secretariat of PAIGC, and he's also a steering committee member of Black Alliance for Peace's U.S. Out of Africa Network, and he's also on the Coordination Committee of the West African People's Organization. Here is my conversation yesterday with Imani Naumoja. Imani Naumoja, welcome to our show.
Thank you, my brother and comrade Mwiza. It's a Thank pleasure you. To be with you.
It's a pleasure to talking to you right there in the, as they say, in the midst of the action that's taking place in Guinea-Bissau. If you could let us know, describe the situation, the environment in Guinea-Bissau presently.
Guinea-Bissau is going through another very intense political moment because the struggle for power has reached another climax. That is to say that there are a lot of interests at stake. In addition to Guinea-Bissau having a lot of natural resources, about 100 strategic minerals, we also have a lot of petroleum that has not been tapped yet. We also have a very deep water port, one of the deepest water ports in Africa. It's among the top three. And that's very important because of transportation, international transportation, as well as for the landlocked countries like Mali, which is not far from us, because you know we have two borders. In addition to the sea border, we have a border with Senegal to the north, and we have a border with Guinea-Conakry to the northeast and to the east, southeast of our country. And those two countries, Senegal and Guinea-Conakry, have a border with Mali. Mali also has a border with Burkina Faso, which is also landlocked, and Niger, which is also landlocked. And so those countries, when they import a lot of their items, they import them through ships. So during the time of colonialism, the ships would go to ports like the port of Dakar, and that's a railroad that would transport it from Dakar to places like Bamako in Mali, Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso. But with a deep water port in southern Guinea-Bissau, it would be cheaper for them to be able to import it through Guinea-Bissau, because with ships, the larger the ship, the more economical. With the deep water port in southern Guinea-Bissau, it has the potential of allowing four very large ships to anchor at the same time, which means if you have very sophisticated modern equipment to unload the ships, it won't take long to unload them, so other ships could come in very fast. Presently, you have smaller ships, and when they come, they have to wait maybe 5 days to unload. But with proper equipment, you can unload four ships in 5 hours, which means it's more economical for them. So the economic situation would really change. And it's also very important to understand that a lot of the ports in Africa are owned by a private company in France called Bellore, B-E-L-O-R-E, with an accent on the E, Bellore. So that there's a lot of interest at stake. It's also a lot of interest at stake for narco trafficking, because a lot of the illegal drugs that come from Southern America to go to Europe, they usually stop through Africa on the way. And the best place for them are places like Guinea-Bissau, which has 88 islands. We're the only country in Africa that has that many islands, and half of the islands are uninhabited. So they can use those uninhabited islands, as well as some of the inhabited islands, to bring their drugs to transfer. So everybody has interest. Now, we, the people, we have an interest of making sure we use the resources to transform our country, to provide for the social services that our people so badly need: health, education, infrastructure development, et cetera. So we need these resources to develop, but the enemy wants to use the resources for themselves. So there's a lot of interest at stake. So the interest of our enemy is to make sure they have their puppets in power so they can usurp all of our resources and keep the people poor in such a rich country. We too have a lot of interest. So our people, more and more, as time goes on, organize ourselves better and better, to the point where during classic colonialism, we were able to organize the people to overthrow the colonists. That is to say, Portugal gave the face, but behind Portugal colonialists, you have NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organizations, which includes the U.S., Canada, France, Western Germany at that time, England, who used to give guns and a lot of resources to the Portuguese colonists to fight against us, but we whipped them. So from then on, they had to try to use traitors to try to overthrow the PIGC. And they have done that several times, but I think we're the only revolutionary party in Africa that lost state power and came back to power again several times. And this is another one of those times where we were illegally kicked out of power, but then we came back to semi-power in 2023 through legislative elections, to the surprise of all, not just the enemy, but even some of the revolutionary forces in the world. They didn't think, with all the disadvantages that we had against the advantages of our enemy, they didn't think that we would win, but we won. So they had to fight again now, illegally sack our government, illegally dissolve the National People's Assembly. So we organized ourselves even more. And then we had elections finally on the 23rd of November last week. And to their surprise again, we won. So they have to do what they can to stop the election results from being published. But fortunately, the people were more organized because of experience we have. And people took ownership of the process. Everywhere there were voting tables throughout the country in the diaspora, people would gather around the tables from early in the morning before they opened up to late at night after they closed. And they would witness the counting of the votes manually, as well as witness when the electoral officials, along with the representatives of the candidates, as well as the representatives from the public ministry, which I think you would call like a district attorney in the U.S., and they would all count them together, and they had to publish them on a sheet of paper signed by all of them with the official stamp, and they had to post it by the table. So our people, they monitored that process. And then now when the votes were taken with the voting booths to the regional electoral commissions, our people camped around these regional commission offices and resisted all the attempts by the neocolonial puppets to try to change the results. So that really surprised them. So they had to be even more desperate to try to get the official try to prevent the official results from getting to the National Electoral Commission office. So on the 26th of November, a few days ago, they were desperate. So they decided to invade the National Electoral Commission's office in the daylight, like afternoon, but a little bit before 1 o'clock. with guns shooting in the air to make people panic, and insisted that the voting officials give them their computers, their cell phones, all the things, that the voting minutes, the minutes from the tally sheets. But there was a resistance there too. So there's a lot at stake right now. And so since the illegal neocolonial president realized that that he had been out-organized, he decided to do another desperate attempt to try to stage a fake coup against himself and giving instructions to the paramilitary, including his private militia, to go into these, to the National Electoral Council and destroy those, but also to arrest the president-elect, whose name is Fernando Diaz da Costa, as well as the president of the PEIGC, who is also the president of the National People's Assembly, along with some other voting electoral commission officials and public magistrates. They arrested them. And the following day, he left the country, stopped to Senegal for a little while, but there's a lot of resistance there. People protested against his presence. So he went to Congo Brazzaville, where he's together with his neocolonial father, Denis Sassou Nguesso. And from there now, he's trying to continue to stabilize our country.
Oh, sorry. I just wanted to take a short break in terms of when you're to expect. So for those who are just getting up to speed of Guinea-Bissau, because most of, unfortunately, we don't get to hear much from Guinea-Bissau here in the USA. But if you can also contextualize the PAIGC a little bit in terms of the history, explaining to people, you know, the founder. When they hear of Amilcar Cabral, you know, that connection as well. Most people who are listening don't see that connection oftentimes. You know, talked a little bit about, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm saying this is very key what you're saying, because that's another thing that the enemy does. They try to keep us ignorant. They try to keep us uninformed so that we can't think. Because in order to think, you have to have information to think about. So if you don't have the information, you can't even think about it. You might even think that you're thinking, but you can't really think about it. Because they don't want you to know the revolutionary examples, because they know that our people want justice. They were founded examples. Amilcar Cabral is among the greatest revolutionaries in the world. Fidel Castro said that he was the most clear and brilliant of Africa. Others have said similar things. So he was able to, while he was studying in the university in Portugal, to bring together other Africans who were studying there to have work study groups where they were studying the reality of Africa, history of the world, philosophies. And among themselves, they divided and went back to the colonies where they were born to organize revolutionary organizations. And when they organized the revolutionary organizations, they coordinated them together. In Angola, they founded the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, MPLA. Its first president was Agostinho Neto, who was in that study group with Cabral. But Cabral is also one of the co-founders of the MPLA. Before they founded the MPLA in 1956 in Angola, they had already founded another Pan-Africanist revolutionary party called the Partido Unido de Lutas Africanos de Angola, the United Party of Africans in Angola, the Party of the United Struggle of Africans in Angola. In Guinea-Bissau, Amilcar Cabral, along with other revolutionaries, founded the African Party of Independence. That was the original name. They didn't put GC at first. They just put African Party of Independence as a revolutionary, mass-based Pan-Africanist party for both Guinea-Bissau and the Cape Verde Islands. And for our listeners who don't know about the geography, the Cape Verde Islands are not the islands that I was referring to earlier. The 88 islands that I was referring to earlier called the Bisigo Islands, which are geographically very, very close to Guinea-Bissau. But Cape Verde is more geographically close to Dakar, Senegal. But they were both colonized by the Portuguese, and a lot of the people who inhabited the Cape Verde Islands were taken to Cape Verde during the time of the slave trade. Not only did you have one party for Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, but the same party, PAIGC, coordinated a struggle and was influential in the founding of the Liberation Front for Mozambique, the Frelimo, as well as with the popular the Movement for Liberation of San Tome and Principe. San Tome and Principe is geographically close to Gabon. So you had four different revolutionary organizations being coordinated by what they call CONCP, the Conference of Nationalist Organizations in the Portuguese Colonies, for the first time in Africa. Now, the brilliance of Amilcar Cabral, in addition to this, is that he had a very rare opportunity to study reality in various parts. First of all, in Guinea-Bissau, since he was an agriculture agronomist engineer, he was able to do a survey throughout the whole country, going into the different villages to find out about their agricultural reality. You know, did they grow groundnuts, peanuts, or corn, maize, or rice? But he used that as an opportunity to study our people. And he himself said that he was surprised to see how high the level of culture of our people is, even though the overwhelming majority, almost all of our people, were not allowed to go to school. As a consequence, 99% of the people in Guinea-Bissau were illiterate. That said, they didn't have formal education. They weren't doctors or lawyers or engineers, but they still do have a very high level of culture and a high level of resistance based upon that high level of culture. So this really helped to make the party more mass-based, not just in terminology, but in practice. So as a result of studying this reality and putting it into practice, he was able to put some of his observations and presentations and texts. And so a lot of people studied these texts and saw a few of these excerpts of videos and inspired them, even where you are. You find a lot of people throughout the U.S., particularly the revolutionaries, said they were inspired by Cabral. Just to give you an example, in 1972, at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, Cabral was given his honorary doctorate degree and used that as an opportunity to present one of his last theses called Identity and Dignity in the Context of the Liberation Struggle. And we strongly, strongly encourage listeners to read that. It's in a book called Return to the Source, which you can get through the internet without paying anything, because somebody was so nice that they made a scan of it and put in a PDF and put it online. Return to the Source. You also see other very important theses of Cabral, like, for example, National Liberation and Culture, and also things like How to Apply the Party Principles in Practice. So in other words, he didn't just photocopy what people were doing in Vietnam or China. Of course, he studied Mao Zedong, visited China, studied the reality there, visited Vietnam, had conversation with Ho Chi Minh and other leaders of the Communist Party of Vietnam and the National Liberation Front. But there were also, the PIDC was based in Guinea-Conakry. At that time, it was called the People's Revolutionary Republic of Guinea, led by the PDGRDA. The PDGRDA.
That's under secretary. Under secretary.
Exactly. Exactly. Go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry to interject. I also wanted,
no problem.
No, you can go ahead and you can, and of course, the secretary was another revolutionary independence leader
who also had another opportunity to study his people because he was a trade union organizer. And I mean, active trade union organizer with the people, not just with the workers, they involved the people. You know, some trade unions just isolate themselves to workers who work in factories. And, you know, in Africa, we're not in many factories. The main works we have are those who work in the fields, what you call farmers, or some people call them peasants. So Sekou was able to go throughout the country of Guinea-Conakry when it was still colonized by the French and organize the people along with other parties in West Africa that were colonized by the French to form an organization called the RDA, which is in French, which is the Rassemblement Democratique Africain, which means the African Democratic Gathering. And each of those went back to their countries and formed the Democratic Party. So like in Senegal, they formed the Democratic Party of Senegal. In Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, they formed the Democratic Party of Cote d'Ivoire, et cetera. And in Guinea-Conakry, they formed the Democratic Party of Guinea. And so they coordinated their struggle together and they did strikes against the French. I mean, they carried out a big strike against the railroad that would go from Dakar to Mali, to Burkina Faso, to Guinea-Conakry. They stopped them for 70 days. So Sekou Touré had based the revolution on the mass of the people. And Amilcar Cabral had the opportunity to be in Guinea-Conakry while all of this was going on. And while you also had embassies from other revolutionary countries, like the People's Republic of China, you had Cuba. And so he was able to also spend time visiting some of the neo-colonial countries that just recently got their sham independence, like Senegal, for example. So he was able, and Congo, where the struggle, when the struggle was going on after Lumumba was killed, there was a popular movement that was continuing those works, and you had a lot of Cubans involved. So Cabral was able to absorb the reality of the metropole of Portugal. He visited the U.S., visited England a couple of times, France. So he had this global reality. He was able to reproduce with the people in the PIGC party, particularly the youth. Because since I told you earlier that we had 99% of our people illiterate, one of the first things that we did was once they began to liberate territories against the South, they said we had to put schools in these liberated zones. Some people would resist. How can you put schools when you're fighting? The brother said, if we don't put schools, we don't need to liberate the zones. And then putting some clinics, but not the health clinics where you have these buildings. Sometimes you'd be under the mango tree, under the cashew tree, and making sure, you know, some doctors from Cuba helped us. They also helped us to train some of our people to become nurses. Meanwhile, sent our children to places like Cuba, the Soviet Union, to China, to Algeria, to study, to become doctors, nurses, health workers, etc. And he also organized popular judicial committees in the villages. So the people who live in the village themselves will carry out justice in their village. And if you want to get an appeal to your decision, go to a sectoral commission of justice, and then from there to a regional one or to the central level. So for the first time in the history of our people since colonialism, our people were involved in making decisions from the conception to the decision and implement those decisions and consolidate those decisions they make, be involved with their own justice. At the same time, they were studying theory. He organized another school in Guinea-Conakry called the Pilot School, but not for airplane pilots, like a model school. So the best students in the liberated zones, when they got to the fifth grade, they would send them to Conakry, close to where Cabral had the national the international headquarters of the PIGC. But for the girls, instead of waiting to the fifth grade, they selected them from the third grade and gave them a double. They would skip the fourth grade and go straight to the fifth grade. And not only were they close to Cabral used to go there every day when he was in the country, but they also had teachers who taught them with love, taught them the real geography of the world, history of the world, at the same time teaching the sciences, physics, mathematics, etc. And then had them involved with doing the same type of chores, boys and girls, going to get the firewood together, going to fetch the water together, sewing together, cooking together, cleaning together, to create this new man and new woman. And then when they got to the age of high school, they were sent to socialist countries like the Soviet Union, China, Algeria, Cuba, etc. So they could continue their studies in the technological areas and technology areas.
So and it's a great history. And I also wanted to give so that people have a context of the party and also the history of Guinea-Bissau as before we get into the weeds of what's happening now. And before we go, I also wanted to reintroduce you. That's Imani Na Umoja, and he's a member of the Political Bureau and also a member of the National Secretariat and of the African Party of Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. That's PAIGC. And he was giving us a context of the situation in Guinea-Bissau today, the environment and the issues as well, but also giving us the historical background. Now, we wanted to fast forward a bit to the present situation because we have this as you mentioned, what people have seen as a stage coup by the president who said who's been ousted on November 26th. That's former President Omora Sesoko Embalo. If you could explain this situation of the PAIGC, you were in parliament, you were the biggest party in parliament, but almost a similar situation happened a couple of years ago, right? So that people have a proper context of why people are seeing this not necessarily as a coup.
If you want to refer to it a coup, then you must be precise. Say it's a coup against the president-elect, Fernando Diaz da Costa. A coup to stop him from taking his oath of office as the president. So they did the coup before the official results were given by the Electoral Commission. But the reason why we say that we want to dispel the lies of Imamoto Sissoko Mbalo is that he himself is the one who got in contact with news agencies as well as some presidents to say, yeah, you know, I'm victimized by a coup. Huh? The military is taking power. You know, he kept his telephones all the time. But he's the one doing the press conferences and saying there's a coup going on. And then finally, a couple hours later, a group of military who are all very close to him. Of course, they cut off all the radio stations, but they took over the television station and read a prepared statement saying that, yeah, you know, we did the coup because there was a threat of instability in the country based upon the elections that just happened. And some people involved with drug trafficking and they were about to carry out some chaos. So we decided to overthrow the president. And so now we're taking over the high command for restoration of order. And we have all the power. We got total control of the country. The borders are closed. All the airport and all the ports are closed. And so we're the ones going to make all the decisions from now on. And we're going to do a transition for a year. But while that was going on, they went to the headquarters of Fernando Diaz da Costa, where Domingo Simons Pereira, the president of the National People's Assembly, president of the PAIGC, was in a meeting with the international observers from ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, the African Union, what they call the West African Committee for Wise Elders, led by the former Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan. They had just finished their meeting. So Fernando Diaz da Costa was there with his staff, Domingo Simons Pereira there with his staff, and he had a lot of people working at the headquarters were there. And as soon as the international observers left, some armed masked men invaded the headquarters and tried to get Fernando Diaz da Costa, but the people around him fought those who came in, got into a car, and got away from the back door. But unfortunately for Domingo Simons Pereira and some other members of the party of Fernando Diaz da Costa called the PRS, the Social Renewal Party, and some of our comrades in the PAIGC got apprehended by these armed masked elements, the militia from Sokoko.
And Simon Pereira is the president of the PAIGC, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So they got him. They got them. And then they also simultaneously arrested some of the authorities from the National Electoral Commission, as well as some of the public attorneys who were assigned to the National Electoral Commission. They arrested them as well. They took them all to some jail cells next to the Ministry of Interior. Now, according to Sokoko's public statements, when he announced that he was a victim of a coup, when he was supposedly apprehended by some coup makers, he also said that it was not only him that was apprehended, but the Minister of Interior, the General Army Chief of Staff, as well as the Assistant Army Chief of Staff. Now, I want our listeners to analyze this logically. If a real coup happened against a Minister of Interior, they would also arrest the other ministers. They didn't do that. If you arrested the Army General Chief of Staff and the Assistant Army Chief of Staff, and that means to say that you would probably arrest their collaborators. They didn't arrest anybody else. And up to now, they never showed us any images of these other people. Not only did they not show us images, photo or video of the Minister of Interior, but his son is also a high authority in the Ministry of Interior. And he's the one of the people going around arresting people. So now, if his father was victimized by a coup and in the hands of the coup maker, why be going around with the coup makers arresting people who are against the coup? You know, this is one of those desperate attempts, thinking that, you know, they don't have anything else to do. So this, anything is better than nothing. We like to say that if you're on a, give an example, if you're on a ship in the high water, in the ocean, and the ship begins to sink, and you don't know how to swim. You see even a leaf passing by. You say, let me grab this leaf, and maybe it'll save my life. It won't save your life. So as you say, anything is better than nothing. So that's why they did this. They said, okay, we cannot let these election results be announced, because it's the end of their rule. And their rule is not just them. Their rule is for the French imperialists. We can say collective imperialism, but more directly French imperialism.
You're listening to a recent conversation with Imani Naumoja, who's a member of the Political Bureau and National Secretariat of the African Party of Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde, PAIGC, and he's also a steering committee member of Black Alliance for Peace's U.S. Out of Africa network. In the conversation, he dissects and contextualizes the current political situation in Guinea-Bissau, and he was speaking to us directly from Guinea-Bissau. The music in the background is Subukwe by Ezra Mpungukana, and we play that remembering liberation leader Robert Subukwe's birthday, which is December 5th. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
If you look at most of the contracts that were illegally signed by Mata Sokoko and Mbalo, they were to the benefit of the French capitalists, but also the U.S. capitalists as well. If you look at the secret agreement he made with the former president of Senegal, Macky Sall, to exploit our petroleum, it's in the favor of Total, OTL, fuel station, petroleum corporation owned by French capitalists. If you look at the other secret agreements he's trying to make with all the other our resources, natural resources, and our port, similar thing. And one of the first places that he wanted to go with France.
Also, if you can also connect that that train of thought with when the other place that he goes to is the Republic of Congo Brazzaville.
Congo Brazzaville.
And then also the significance of that, especially when you mentioned the fact that Total is one of the signatures, because Total is also heavily invested in the exploitation of the oil in Congo, right?
Exactly. And then Sassou Nguesso is one of the main neocolonial puppets for the French in Africa. So those are the connections that are there. But going back to the fake coup, after they announced, after the so-called coup makers, they are coup makers, they did a coup against us, and they still have our president in their custody, as well as other authorities of the PIGC and the PRS. And the day before yesterday, released a couple of the officials from the National Electoral Commission so that they can go through some more theater that I'm going to come to right now. When they announced that they were going to form a so-called government, the person who they appointed to be the illegal prime minister, his name is Elidio Vierte. He was the campaign director for Omar Sokoko's attempt to be reelected. He was also the minister of finance who used to take all the money from our treasury between him and a small group of the Omar Sokoko and Mbalo for their own bellies, but as well as to put into their campaign against us. So this is the person who now is the so-called prime minister. So now if you say you're doing a coup against the president, you're going to do a coup against all those people with that same interest. And then now he turns around and says he's appointing a government, an illegal government. If you look at all the people who are in that illegal government, they're the same collaborators. You have among them a few traitors from the PIDC. They're not real PIDC, but they were people who were in the PIDC working against what we call the fifth column. Those are the ones he put into this so-called coup government.
And also, before we go, if you could also elaborate a bit more about the how the PAIGC was also, you know, in the past, they tried to, in this process has always been, always tried to put the PAIGC on the sidelines illegally. Especially in this past election, for instance, and then also in before that as well, so that people have a proper understanding why people are saying this is a staged coup, so that somebody who's doesn't follow it, you know, in a day to day, understands where it's coming from. Because this, as I said before, in the past they tried to illegally sideline certain groups, or also take away the vote, as you mentioned, that was people had voted one way, and then they tried to have a stage that coup again. So if you can give us that in full, so that we have a clear understanding, because somebody say, well, what, how can it be a stage coup?
Yeah, that's very good. You know, the struggles against the PIDC are constant, because the struggle against our people are constant, because the struggles of our enemy is to make sure they take all of our resources, including our human resources. So it's only natural they will have to fight against the instrument that our people created. The people created a party. And with this party now, just to give you some recent examples, because there are many examples, just give some of the recent examples of some of the things they've done against us. Even right now, as I'm talking to you, they occupied our headquarters. That's now. But it's not the first time they invaded our headquarters. In 2022, we were preparing to have a Congress. We have ordinary Congresses every 4 years. Now, leading up to the Congress, you have what we call assemblies of our base of the party. And those delegates go from the assemblies of the base to a conference of the sections, which is a group of bases. Those delegates who are elected, they go to a conference of the sectors. We have 48 sectors inside the country, and inside the city of Bissau, we have six different sectors. We call them zones in Bissau. Those delegates go to a regional conference, and then from there, you elect delegates to go to the Congress. Several times, they would interrupt our base assemblies as well as our, every type of conference. We had the section conference, the sector conference. Sometimes they've had people invade our sector headquarters with chains to close, to lock the doors up. Sometimes invade the meetings when they're going on. And even in March of 2022, we were preparing to have the Congress the following day. They invaded our headquarters and start bombing us up with all this tear gas they got from Israel, from occupied Palestine, arrested some of our people and chased us out of the headquarters and occupied the headquarters. We had to come back the next day. Our people were doing the protest in the street, and they shot them. They bombed them up with tear gas as well. Another time we were going to have our Congress in 2018, they also invaded our headquarters and stayed there for a few days until we had enough resistance to get them out. In order to try to stop us from having our Congress, they propped up a traitor who said he was a member of the PIC, who was not allowed to be a part of the sector conference, which was a lie. He'd already left the party. He was one of the person who came to the party for a couple of years and went to another party. They gave him money to say that he was blocked from going to the Congress. So we had to challenge him in court, and that delayed the Congress from happening. And then we finally had the Congress. They invaded the Congress grounds. We had about 1,200 delegates. We opened up the Congress like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We're going to take a break at 9 o'clock. And here come these masked armed men with police uniforms on, and said they wanted to arrest one of the comrades was there, you know. So a lot of people saw a gun, they started running. But the overwhelming majority of our people stood their ground. Said, well, you ain't going to arrest nobody here. You ain't going to arrest Congress. You know, that was to try to make us be afraid to not have the Congress. We met at 5 o'clock in the morning. After we left the Congress hall, about 2 miles away, they had other police on the side of the road stopping all of our cars and checking our cars to try to intimidate us. And then the following morning, they had a whole bunch of military in the area surrounding the Congress house, so they thought we'd be afraid to go in there. We went in there. And then when we decided to form a coalition with some other parties that assembled to us, we called it the PAI Terra Ranca. Terra Ranca means develop the land. They said we cannot use the PIGC flag as our logo because the PIGC is in a coalition. So we had to come up with another logo 30 days before the election. We came up with the logo that has a big house with the same Pan-African colors of the PIGC flag. And now we have to have campaign material to make sure we go into the village. Just explain to people, when you go into the voting booth, don't look for the flag. Look for this house with the same colors as the flag. So we didn't have much money, but we were able to get some donations, and some of our campaign equipment was coming by plane. The plane landed in the airport in Bissau, and they stopped us from unloading the plane. So we couldn't get our campaign materials. So we made an agreement with the airline to go to Gambia, which is not too far from here, and maybe about 8 hours by car. And we said, we'll get it there. But the neocolonial ex-president here got in contact with the neocolonial president in Gambia and stopped it from being unloaded there. So can you imagine a party that has about 200,000 militants with no campaign materials competing against this neocolonial force to get all these millions of dollars worth of campaign equipment from France, from the U.S., and some of Congo, Brazzaville. I mean, they got all types of new cars, motorcycles, banners, T-shirts, caps, the big signs, all the posters all over the place. And of course, pouring a lot of money into the village to try to buy out the leadership of the village, particularly in the villages where you have feudal type of tribes. That is say, you have one ruler who sits on top of another ruler who tries to control the people in their village. So they'll pump money in there, et cetera. And we had to challenge all that. We did most of our campaigning on foot without access to T-shirts and campaign. So everybody said, we're going to lose, including the ex-president. He said it several times. First of all, he used to say publicly, he's going to get rid of the PIGC. Then he said, before the elections that happened in 2023, there's no way in the world that the PIC will come even close to winning. Out of the 102 seats in the National People's Assembly, which is our legislature, like you have Congress in the U.S., we have what we call the National People's Assembly, the parliament. He said that out of 102 seats, the PIC won't even get 15. If they're lucky, they might get 19. But there's no way in the world to get more than 19. I'll tell you right now, if they get 25, I'll resign. Yeah, I'm telling you. If they get 25, I'll leave the presidential palace. We got the overwhelming majority. So they were shocked because of the people, the conscience of our people, and the organization of our people. So this is in 2023 in June. Now, normally, when the election's over, you're supposed to swiftly swear in the members of parliament. We call them deputies. But they dragged out the process from June up until the end of July, the 27th of July. They finally swore in our National People's Assembly with Domingo Simoes Pereira as the president of the National People's Assembly. And with our structure, it's not like the U.S. In the U.S., you're like a president. That president is the one who appoints the different secretaries of education, of transportation, etc. Whereas here, it's the party that wins the overwhelming majority of votes. It's the one who proposes who's going to be the prime minister, and the president has no choice but to give that prime minister the post, to inaugurate that prime minister. And the prime minister will propose the members of the government, and the president has to give a post to those who are in the government. So now you have a National People's Assembly that took posts on the 27th of July. But the government was inaugurated on the 13th of August. So then we started hearing rumors, this government won't last long from the neocolonial side. And sure enough, what they said happened. 3-4 months later, the ex-neocolonial president said, yeah, you know, they tried to do a coup against me because, the Minister of Economy and Finance stole some money, and the state treasury stole some money. And so we arrested them, and other people took them out of jail and took the National Guard headquarters. And this is an attempted coup. It didn't fit in nobody's head. But he used that excuse to say, so now I'm going to dissolve the National People's Assembly. Now, just for the listeners to understand how wild this is, in the Constitution of Guinea-Bissau, it says that when the National People's Assembly, our parliament, when it's inaugurated, nobody can dissolve it for at least 12 months, 1 year, no matter if there's a war going on, anything going on. And we have precedence to this. In 1998, we had a war. And during that war, the National People's Assembly continued to function until the end of the war. But here you have an accusation from one person who was out of the country at the time, who really should have, according to the Constitution, when the president is not available, it's the president of the National Assembly that substitutes him or her, which means that Domingo Simoes Pereira should have been the interim president at the time. But they started shooting close to his house at the National Guard headquarters. And his security thought they were shooting at his house. So he had to leave with his mother at that time. She was 105. She just made her transition about a year later. We said a few months later, we said that shock probably would contribute to her death, even though she was, 105 years old. I mean, he had to leave his house with his elderly mother to go to a safe place. And so now when this neocolonial president was out of the country, when he came back, he said, yeah, and Domingo Simoes Pereira was involved with this attempt. So he used that as a lame excuse to dissolve the National People's Assembly against the Constitution. Even if it had been a year after the election, where legally he could dissolve the National People's Assembly, the Constitution says only if there's a serious crisis among the government. That's to say that the government is not getting along with the parliament, or the parliament is not getting under a serious crisis. Can you dissolve the assembly after 12 months? But if you do that, you have to call for elections no later than 90 days. So he unconstitutionally dissolves this National People's Assembly on the 4th of December 2023, which means no later than March 2024, who should have had legislative election. But just pushed it back and pushed it back using all these lame excuses. And he himself unilaterally proposed a date. Not proposed, he set a date. He said, okay, we'll have elections in November of 2024. But then he unconstitutionally appointed a government he called the Government of Presidential Initiative. We don't have that in our structure. Our government comes from the parliament. So now with this so-called Government of Presidential Initiative, they just dragged their feet and just a few weeks before the election was supposed to happen in November, they said, we don't have the proper condition to have election. We have to have another date. So that's when he proposed another date. I think it was supposed to be like March of 2025, and then say, okay, no, it would be November of 2025. But now, according to our constitution, the presidential term is 5 years. This neocolonial puppet, Umaru Sissoco Embalo, was inaugurated on the 27th of February, 2020, more than 5 years ago, 2020, which means the term of office ends on the 27th of February, 2025. The constitution says that before the term of office ends, elections should take place within 3 months before. So that if there's a runoff election, you still have time after the runoff election to prepare the transition. But now they used an excuse. They sent some armed men to surround the headquarters of the Supreme Court and the house of the president of the Supreme Court for 3 days and forced him to resign. And they illegally, unconstitutionally appointed who's supposed to be a so-called president of the Supreme Court. And then he abused powers to dismiss 5 judges. Of the 11, of the total of 11 judges, they dismissed 5 unconstitutionally. Then after they were fed up with him, they got rid of him and put another illegal one in who was even worse than him, so that they can prepare for when they will finally have to have elections, so they could block other candidates from being candidates. The other thing he did was he had this so-called Government of Presidential Initiative do another voter registration drive where they would give voter cards to babies who are breastfeeding, to dead people who are already buried in the cemeteries, and to people from Senegal and Gambia and Guinea-Conakry who they can transport into the country to vote for them. So they did all these different things against us. And they spread all kind of rumors. They did everything they could. Finally, when we got close to having these elections, let me go back a step here. The Economic Community of West African States had a states meeting in June, because a lot of them were fed up with it. They say, okay, now these elections have to take, since he proposed the date of November, which is after his mandate ends, his term of office ends, then we're going to stick to that date. But that date could not fail. You have to have the elections on the 23rd of November, the date you set. So he also used the same illegal Supreme Court is supposed to have, they according to their rules and regulations, to have a quorum, they have to have 4/5 of the judges present when they make a decision. So out of 11, 4/5 is 8. It's actually 8.8, but since a human being cannot be 0.8, we'll say 8. Really can round out to 9, but let's say 8. He only had 6 present when they said that no, the petition from the PIDC to run as a coalition with the PAI Tataranka was submitted too late. And the candidacy for Domingos Pons Pereira was submitted too late. The deadline was the 25th of September. We submitted all of our information on the 19th. We chose the date of the 19th because that's the anniversary of the party. So you still had 6 days left. But they didn't even have a plenary meeting to say anything about it. They just had a press conference. Yeah, we know the PIDC submitted their documents too late, so they won't be able to run. They did the same thing with several other parties.
You've just been listening to a portion of a conversation with Imanina Umoja, who is a member of the Political Bureau and the National Secretariat of the African Party of Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde, PAIGC, and he's also a steering committee member of Black Alliance for Peace's U.S. Out of Africa network, and he's also on the coordination committee of the West African People's Organization, WAPO. In the conversation, he dissects and contextualizes the situation in Guinea-Bissau. And he was speaking to us directly from Guinea-Bissau. On November 26th in Guinea-Bissau, people woke up to hear there had been a military coup in their country. Many within the country and beyond have questioned whether it was actually a military coup, but rather it was a plan by the incumbent president, Mbalo, and other forces aligned with him to prevent the official release of the November 23rd presidential and legislative elections. The music in the background is Uhuru by Osibisa, remembering Teddy Osei's birthday, which is on December 1st. And we play that remembering Teddy Osei, who was the co-founder and leader of Osibisa. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Moise Muntali. Up next is Headline News, and that's followed by Sha'anana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly spotlighting on the issues concerning Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by the Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Sojourner Truth with Nana Gainfi. And that's followed by Combit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nicella and Claire Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Fernand Gonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdersen. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW. Special thanks for assistance in today's show to Netra Freeman of Voices with Vision and Black Alliance for Peace. And thank you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Guinea-Bissau by Justino Delgado. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
Guinea, Guinea. Amontate ne cada casabio. Guinea, Guinea. Abissão, anha pubis, vamos tanto na cara foram tanto. Ai.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, December 3rd. Here are some headlines. The Trump administration launched immigration enforcement operations in New Orleans and Minneapolis today, a day after Trump ended a cabinet meeting by unleashing a tirade against Minnesota's population of Somalis, saying, quote, "They should go back to where they came from," close quote. Upon hearing of the operation, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey held a press conference yesterday and vowed his support to the city's Somali community, which is the largest in the nation.
Our values and our commitment to the Somali community, to every community of immigrants and people in our city, is rock solid and will be unwavering. Our police, many of whom are Somali themselves, are trusted partners in keeping people safe. They will not collaborate with any federal agency around doing immigration enforcement work. Our city staff and our law enforcement will not ask the question as to whether an individual is documented or not.
President Trump has threatened to withhold federal funds from cities that interfere with immigration enforcement. In related news, the Trump administration announced that it has paused green card and U.S. citizenship processing for immigrants from 19 countries already subject to a travel ban put in place earlier this year. This follows the Trump administration's announcement that it was pausing all asylum decisions for immigrants currently in the United States after an Afghan national was charged with murdering a National Guard member and critically injuring another in Washington, D.C. last week. He has pleaded not guilty. In more news, several nations in Southeast Asia, including Sri Lanka and Indonesia, were hit by heavy storms last week, leading to a high death toll. WPFW's Noah Portner has this report.
Three cyclones tore through Southeast Asia this week, leaving behind billions of dollars in damages and killing at least 1,350 people, with hundreds still missing. Much of the death toll came from flash flooding and landslides in mountainous regions of Sri Lanka and Thailand. Experts say that deforestation has created this crisis. Indonesia was also hard hit, especially in regions where illegal logging has weakened the soil. The weather cycle known as La Niña is also exacerbating the situation, with strong winds pushing warm waters into the region. And of course, climate change continues to worsen storms, as hotter air can hold more moisture and hotter water spawns more storms. The storm is creating a huge number of displaced people, with over 500,000 people displaced in Indonesia alone and over 2 million in Thailand. Aid continues to flood into the region, but the devastation from the storm is still causing accessibility issues. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
And in more news, in a report released today, Amnesty International accused the paramilitary group fighting against Sudan's military of committing war crimes during its attack earlier this year on the country's largest displacement camp in the Darfur region. Amnesty International said that the RSF's multi-day attack on the camp involved killings of civilians, hostage-taking, the destruction of mosques, schools, and health clinics, and that this was not an isolated attack, but part of a sustained campaign against villages and camps for internally displaced persons. Sudan's war has killed at least 40,000 people and displaced nearly 12 million, creating the world's largest displacement and hunger crisis. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
You're listening to a program previously aired on WPFW. While this is not a live broadcast, we're proud to bring you